Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The perpetrators of mass shootings get different treatment in the media depending on the color of their skin. That's according to an Ohio State University study just out. The study found that white mass shooters are 95% more likely to be considered mentally ill by the media than black mass shooters. And that characterization humanizes and therefore elicits sympathy. Joining us is OSU doctoral student in sociology and lead author of the study, Scott Duxbury. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
How does the definition of a mass shooting play into this dynamic in the first place? What do we mean by that?
So the way we defined mass shootings was a single shooting where four or more people were shot or injured, excluding the perpetrator. And that tends to be the most commonly used definition in the broader empirical literature on mass shootings. Basically, the way we consider mass shootings is as a routine form of mass violence, which is merely a matter of scale rather than any kind of other peculiarity of the crime.
Intent?
Mm-hmm.
Is that brought into it?
So
if somebody goes in and is taken out before they can complete their goal, does that matter?
Could you explain a little bit more?
Well, maybe someone's going to go in and they want to shoot everybody in the room, but after they've shot a couple people, they're taken out.
Mm-hmm.
They can't complete their goal.
Right. Yeah. So when we talk about these kind of what the FBI calls active shooter situations, that's more what kind of comes to mind when we talk about mass shootings. And part of that is because of the sensationalization of the event themselves. So in terms of the definition we use and the most common one, we don't factor that in.
When you talk about the reference to mental illness when it comes to characterizing the shooter in any of these cases, how does the media did you look at how the media comes to the conclusion of mental illness in the first place?
A lot of it had to do with the behaviors of the shooter leading up to the event.
Okay.
So oftentimes it was discussing the shooter as somebody who was exhibiting bizarre behaviors beforehand, entertaining suicidal thoughts, experiencing depression or loneliness or other types of language like that.
Did you try to measure the emphasis put on potential mental illness?
We just used a binary, so zero or one.
Okay. Are there enough mass shootings out there to help us really understand what a typical shooter would be anyway?
So, yes. In the way we define it, there certainly is. Mass shootings are surprisingly common when you consider them as a routine form of mass violence. We end up having something like 350 a year, or about one per day nationally.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Joining us now is an OSU communications professor and former newspaper reporter, Lanier Holt. His research examines the sociological and psychological effect media messages have on people's perceptions of African Americans, women, and other traditionally marginalized groups. Lanier, you have two perspectives, that of a working newspaper journalist and that of a researcher on how media messages affect perception. Where do the miscalculations by journalists come into play? Or the, maybe miscalculation is a pejorative, an unfair pejorative. Where do the calculations come into play?
Well, I think a lot of times, despite the fact that media professionals, despite what some people may believe, are actually trained to be as non-biased as possible. But these people are not machines. You come in with your own personal biases, and people tend to prefer people that are more similar to them than dissimilar. And what the research shows, and just, I mean, visually, you can just look at the fact that most of the people in the newsroom and most of the people who are sending people out on stories are white. And most of the people that they're actually going to cover are African Americans. I mean, if you look at, say, for example, the city of Chicago, which, as we were mentioning off air before we came on here, a story was just run, I think it was in the Chicago Tribune or sometimes, which basically said between 3 o'clock yesterday and the time I was reading it, which was about 1 o'clock in the morning, 13 people were shot in Chicago. Well, yeah, that's a horrible, violent, ridiculously insane stat, but I can almost guarantee you what these people look like because of the places they actually go to cover the crime. They go to the South Side, they go to the West Sides. So when people leave the newsroom, they have an idea of what a shooter looks like. They have an idea what a violent person looks like. They take their pre-existing beliefs into it. And it's not like cooking. It's more like baking. It's sort of a very precise formula. They have a preconceived belief. They see something that matches it. And then they write the story. So the content isn't that surprising. So that's basically what you come up with in terms of preconceived notions and the reality of what we see in the media.
It's an implicit form of bias then.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're seeing too, Scott?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Just exactly like Lanier was saying, when we see people of color as the perpetrators of mass shooters, it really plays into this idea of what we expect a shooter to be like or a violent person to be like. And a lot of the language is color-coded.
When I think about the kinds of mass shootings that we're seeing, I don't think of someone, a person of color doing that. Is that a bias on my part?
It's largely a bias on the types of shootings that get the most amount of coverage. And so typically the ones that we see that are widely covered tend to be the ones with white perpetrators. And so our instinct is to associate mass shootings as a crime with white men. But the reality is when you actually look in, you know, the large amounts of mass shootings that receive very little coverage, that's not actually the case.
And yet they receive more sympathy. Where does that sympathy come from?
We think it comes from these implicit racial biases. The idea that, you know, and Lanier can tell you more about this, but black men and Latinos are widely criminalized. And we tend to believe that black men and Latinos are more involved in crime and criminally inclined than whites. And so when we see this extremely egregious form of crime like mass violence, we need to come up with another explanation for it that might be distinguishes it from other types of crime.
And Lanier, why do we need to come up with another explanation?
Well, because what we have isn't working and it's inaccurate. I mean, I think one of the biggest things is that the media are not separated from society. What we're seeing with mass shootings is what we see in a lot of areas with regard to the difference in how blacks and whites are treated. For example, when the crack epidemic was running through Chicago and Cleveland and things like that, there was no sympathy. There was no outcry. There was no, these people are victims. It was get tough on drugs. It was images.
Three strikes and you're out.
But right now, if you just do a simple Google search and type in opioid crisis, you see things about sanctuary cities, places like New York City, talking about having places where these addicts can go safely inject themselves. You see celebrities talking about opioid crisis and that this is a problem. This is a much bigger issue than just the media. Blacks do something, it's considered deviant, it's considered violent, it's considered scary. There is no explanation. You're guilty until proven innocent.
And so then when someone who's white does it, you have to think of another.
Exactly.
Another explanation.
Yeah. I mean, for example, if you were to close your eyes right now, any of the viewers in here, and said you're walking the streets of the United States of America, someone's behind you, they're going to do harm to you, where do you think you are? Do you think you're walking down the streets of Upper Arlington? Do you think you're walking the streets of Bexley? No, you're probably envisioning yourself on the east side. And when you envision that person probably isn't a woman. That person probably isn't a white person. The people in the poster children of fear and crime in America are African-American men. So it's not surprising that there is a distinction in terms of how people view what whites do versus blacks do. It's what they've already believed.
There's a continuum, too, though. Latinos, Hispanics, they rank, for lack of a better word, higher on the scale of criminality. They get more sympathy than blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
So this kind of there's an emerging body of research in sociology that essentially talks about how the nature of racism is changing in the United States. And we can see this really apparently with the current concerns about immigration that are kind of really exciting the political climate right now. And a lot of it has to do with this idea that it's not as simple as blacks and whites anymore, but as societies become kind of more diverse, there becomes a more complex continuation across which there is racial discrimination and racism. Of course, whites are still at the top, blacks at the bottom, but Latinos fall in between.
Yeah, there's a we see the same thing mirrored in communications and African-American research. Historically, America's race relations can be viewed as a ladder, what our research shows, in which whites are at the top and blacks are sort of calcified at the bottom. Mm. And other immigrant groups eventually fit somewhere in between. It's, I hate to say it, one of the things that is consistent in America is that eventually all groups, with the exception of African Americans, have been gradually more accepted as de facto whites. I mean, you see the old signs, no Italians.
Mm-hmm.
No Irish.
No Polish. Blah,
no
blah,
Polish.
Blah, right.
But negative opinions about African Americans really haven't changed that much.
And the big distinguishing factor is?
Phenotype. People are blinded by what they see.
Mm-hmm.
people can look and I couldn't tell, say, for example, if someone is Polish, someone is Irish, someone, even religious differences. I couldn't tell if someone was Catholic. It's hard to believe for some people if you look through history and you see at some point people were worried about John Fitzgerald Kennedy being president because he was Catholic. Even anti-Semitism. I can't look at someone and tell they're Jewish. I can look at most people and the first thing I see is if they're black, if they're white. It's sort of like gender. Blacks have always been at this bottom. Asian Americans, Italians, Hispanics, etc. No matter what group, they've been able to assimilate a lot easier than African Americans have.
If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the media's treatment of violent crime when it comes to race. In particular, we're focused on the definition or the how the coverage of mass shootings displays a lot of implicit bias against blacks. Second in that line, people of color. And then at the top, as my guest Lanier Holt just said, of the latter, whites. Lanier Holt is an OSU communications professor, former newspaper reporter. He studies the sociological and psychological effect that media messages have on people's perceptions of African Americans, women, and other traditionally marginalized groups. And also with us, Scott Duxbury. He's a sociology doctoral student at OSU and lead author of a new study that underscores this issue. It found that white mass shooters are 95% more likely to be considered mentally ill by the media than black mass shooters, and that characterization matters. It humanizes and therefore elicits sympathy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the media affects the perceptions of perpetrators of mass shootings, especially when it comes to race, and how that plays out or how you can extrapolate that effect through in any kind of coverage of violent crime. A recent study out of OSU shows that white suspects in mass shootings are treated more sympathetically than people of color, 95% more in the case of black suspects. Still with us is lead author of the OSU study, Scott Duxbury. Scott, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
And OSU professor who studies race and media relations, Lanier Holt. Thanks again for joining us, Lanier.
Glad to be here.
If you have a question or comment out there, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Scott Duxbury, you didn't review coverage by broadcast or web media, and I guess that makes the universe so gigantic. How do you begin to distill? But what are your feelings about that?
Our feelings are largely that we're probably actually underestimating the true disparities out there. And part of the reason for this is that when it comes to web media or, television coverage and broadcast news, it tends to be much more sensationalized. They can portray graphic images. They can talk with on-site correspondents and things like that. And that kind of allows this whole milieu of new channels for implicit biases to show and come through and to couple it with really sensationalized imagery. And so the fact that we only look at news coverage, which goes through much more rigorous kind of copy editing and review, it's probably actually distilling the true relationship that's out there.
You think it could be more than 95%?
I think it could be bigger, yeah.
What do you think, Lanier?
I think he, even though that is one of the limitations of the study, I think he actually accurately captures the essence of what we're actually seeing in as much as one of the things, and this is just anecdotal, there was a columnist on 60 Minutes, a number of you out there might remember this guy named Andy Rooney. And Andy Rooney talked about the fact that television has gotten a lot worse over the years and newspapers have gotten a lot better. And one of the things I've always told my students when I was teaching journalism in Indiana is that if newspapers disappeared, televisions would have to recreate them, because basically newspapers don't exist without TV. If you ever want to find out what's going to be on TV, read your newspaper. So I think he's actually onto something, despite the fact that this is a limitation and that he didn't use every form of media. But at the end of the day, something I'm always amazed at when I see this stat, if you took the average 30-minute newscast and shrunk it down to news pages, how many pages do you think you'd get? The answer is one half of one page. Once you take out the banter between the anchors and when you take out the weather and the sports, there's really not a whole lot there. And anytime anyone's ever fortunate enough to be interviewed by the media, you'll find that something will drive you crazy, which is the media will ask you, especially television media, the same question 25 different times. And you're wondering, are these people insane? Are they on drugs? How is it that they're not figuring out that I'm giving this answer? Well, the answer is they figured it out a long time ago, but what they need for television is what's called a soundbite. The average story is about 30 seconds long. And when I teach PR, I always say, if you really want to get quoted, say something short, pithy, that's memorable. You'll get quoted. If you don't, say something long and nuanced. So what you get is that long nuance sometimes in radio, and you get it in newspapers. So just by getting newspapers, even though you don't get everything, I think you get the general gist of what's actually out there for news.
Yusuf in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Yusuf.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. But anyway, I am very much interested in this topic, and hopefully after this conversation, you and I can have a lot more conversation. But I had recently applied for a teaching position with Columbus Public Schools. I was offered the position, negotiated salary, and scheduled for onboarding. Unfortunately, the job was rescinded based on hearsay, even though they have cleared my background check and everything. So, and not only that, I noticed police officers, agents follow me all over the place. And mind you, I have 5 college degrees with a doctorate, and, you know, haven't been through anything, unfortunately. So I was wondering, why is this situation being propagated by even law enforcement? I went to the FBI, I went to the Columbus City Police to see if I have any criminal history. And they both told me no.
Okay.
And I have a background check.
Well, I guess maybe what Yusuf's suggesting is this, he thinks that he's been profiled and that this is a form of profiling, and that's kind of what's happening in the newspapers that you reviewed for your study, Scott Duxbury.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As Lanier and I have been talking about, these implicit racial biases are very widespread. And so no matter how many times people are vetted or checked, there's kind of this persistent reinforcement of racial otherness.
Mm-hmm. And it affects other walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much so. Sort of to Yusuf's point, and this is sort of to what we were talking about. I mean, it's a little off topic, but what you've probably seen is something that it's actually been shown in business schools. There's a famous study, I think it was conducted by the University of Chicago, that talked about the fact that, I'm going to basically paraphrase it because I don't remember the exact names. It was like, is Malik as employable as Michael?
Mm-hmm.
And it showed that whites are called back far more frequently than African-American or minority applicants. In fact, probably the most disturbing part of that, and what you probably experienced in terms of reaffirming this, in terms of what we were talking about with the media, reaffirming it in other areas, is that whites with criminal records are even called back more frequently with the exact same resume in places like Boston, Chicago, et cetera, than African-Americans, and more than likely the new minority that since September 11th has become in vogue, if for lack of a better way of describing it, to discriminate against Muslim. With the exact same resume, someone with a white-sounding name will be called back more frequently, even with a criminal record, than someone without. Because pure and simple, that's sadly the way America has operated, and people work and are more comfortable with people they find that's their own.
Right. And the name and the names of people, does that play a role in any of this, Scott Duxbury?
It certainly does, especially when it comes to Latinos. A lot of Latinos are fair-skinned, and oftentimes the name can be used as kind of a signal of that racial otherness and kind of encourage people to, or at least play into their implicit racial biases and allow them to kind of treat them as a different group.
People will never say, I didn't hire you because of your name, or I didn't return your call because of your name, or call back for a job interview because of the color of your skin, or anything like that. They'll say they find another reason, don't they?
No, there's a concept, sorry to cut you, called modern racism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea, I mean, it's been going on since I think it was a researcher named Sears in the late 80s came up with this. And the crux of it is blatant forms of racism have gone out of play. People, I mean, probably until fairly recently, wouldn't just come out and say that they're racist. I even tell people, you know, a racist is the second worst thing you could be called in society today. The worst is a pedophile. Because if someone told you, hey, you got a racist living next door to you, you're, oh, good grief, I got to go deal with this fool if such and such happens. You deal with it or you ignore it. Someone tells you you have a pedophile living next door, you move.
Mm-hmm.
The Klan often doesn't say they're racist. They're white supremacists. So no one wants to be outright saying they're racist. So, yeah, no one will actually come out and say it, but they'll act upon it.
Meredith in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Meredith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know if the research looked into religion as a factor as to how mass shootings were portrayed in the media. If so, more specifically, did reports jump to calling a shooter a terrorist, for instance, if they are Muslim?
Hmm. Yeah. Scott Duxbury?
Thank you for the question, Meredith. That's something we really wanted to look into, but unfortunately we didn't have enough time or resources to actually gather data rich enough to look at that. So in our study, we did not. However, I can say that we did have roughly two or three mass shootings we looked at where there was a Middle Eastern perpetrator. And in those cases, the coverage would initially discuss terrorism, but then later recant it when it turned out that they had no affiliation to known organizations.
You know, in Lanier, I know what it's like in a newsroom when this happens.
Oh, yeah.
The pressure to find an explanation is paramount.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of times we never know in the final analysis why someone did something, did what they did. But it is a very common fallback position since 9/11.
Yeah, it's always a pressure in a newsroom where you have the pressure to be right and the pressure to be first.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, especially with the advent of social media, the battle is often won by the desire to be first. Because if you go into any newsroom, they're always doing comparative journalism. What does ABC have? What does NBC have versus what do we have at CBS? And in Chicago, it's what does the Sun-Times have? And if you're at the Sun-Times, what's the Tribune have?
Mm-hmm.
And if one has it going that it's a terrorist, it's that way until proven different.
I think that newsrooms are becoming more cognizant of this knee-jerk reaction to use the word terrorism if someone appears to be of Muslim descent, or whether it's their name or their appearance or whatever. Now what I'm seeing is immediately, as soon as possible, saying terrorism does not seem to play a role. In other words, terrorism might play a role, or it's unclear. Terrorism, you know, they're trying, but it's still popping up because that's something that's popping up in people's brains.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually quite interesting. In the study that we did, we saw similar dynamics in terms of gang violence and mental illness. And so in cases where the shooter was a person of color, it was frequent that they would first say it was gang violence until proven otherwise. And in some cases, they would jump to gang violence and then later find out it was mental illness. Whereas in the case of white shooters, it was quite typical for them to say something along the lines of, he's mentally ill. Oh, wait, no, he is not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Meredith, thanks for that call. Nick? Oops. Nick in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Nick. Hello, Nick. Okay, we'll get Nick later if he's around. Bill in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. When there's a mass shooting and I turn to the traditional mainstream news media, like the New York Times or NPR, the mainstream news media, I see them reporting facts. I see them telling us whether a judge has declared a suspect to be mentally ill I see them reporting whether the suspect has a history of mental illness or seeking treatment for mental illness. I don't see the news media on their own going out on a limb and declaring someone is mentally ill or is not. I just see the mainstream media doing their job reporting the facts.
Go ahead.
I'm not sure where I get this idea that your guests say the news media, the traditional news media, are characterizing people as being mentally ill or not.
So what are the origins of these reports that you can nail down, Scott Duxbury? So I think Bill makes a really good point. You just don't make this up out of, you know, thin air. It comes from somewhere.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great point, Bill. Thank you for bringing it up. The reason that we think that there is this big discrepancy is, of course, in the short amount of time that a news article has to convey facts, they have to be selective about which facts to represent and which facts to portray. And oftentimes what's playing into those is the facts that we expect to resonate with our audiences and the facts that we expect to be believable. And so when it comes to white shooters, if they have a history of mental illness, it might be more likely to be brought up. But we know that there is no difference between the frequency of mental illness between white and black people. And so there's no reason we should expect these discrepancies in the news media unless there are actually basically differences in how the media decides to portray shooters' motives.
Hmm. Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Lanier, what do you think?
Oh, I think he's right. What he's speaking on is this concept, well, this theory in media and probably psychology, maybe sociology as well, called framing. Mm-hmm. And the way you frame a story influences a lot on what people think. The most common adage is if you talk about in health communication, for example, if you have this surgery, you have a 50% chance of surviving it. Or you tell somebody, if you have this surgery, there's a 50% chance you're going to die from it. Most people will take the first option. You didn't change the actual facts. You just changed how you framed it. So if you frame it as mental illness, you tend to evoke feelings of what's going on in the mental health community. You tend to invoke feelings of what's going on in society. And that's the way oftentimes crime is portrayed when it's white-collar crime or involves often Caucasians versus episodic framing, which is, hey, this person did that. Without context, it tends to blame the individual, which is almost all crimes involving African Americans.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to talk about images for just a second, visual images, photographs in newspapers. I think one of the most egregious recent examples that might come to everybody's mind is how the rapist or attempt the guy who attempted to rape the woman behind the dumpster after a frat party or after some kind of party at Stanford. At first, the photos you saw of this guy who happens to come from Ohio, a suburb of Dayton, were his fraternity photo. A nice, beautiful portrait. When in reality, I mean, what wasn't being shown was his perpetrator photo when he was being booked for the crime, which was. Looked like what you would think somebody who would rape a woman behind a dumpster would look like. That happens a lot, the choice of photos. Did you look at that, Scott Duxbury?
Again, we were unable to. When it comes to making sense of images, it introduces a whole ton of statistical issues in terms of how to actually construct the data and measurement. Mm-hmm. That being said, again, we think images are a powerful way that it plays in and constructs these narratives. I mean, you bring up the case of the Stanford swimmer, but I, of course, think of the powerful role of images in the Trayvon Martin case.
Coin, yeah. I mean, Lanier?
Yeah, I was thinking the very same thing. I mean, if you look at somebody and they mesh the image of what you think of as a criminal, your reaction is a lot different than if you look at someone and the first thing you think is, oh my goodness, how can you do that? I mean, for example, probably one of my favorite examples of this is the guy that they called the deliberate stranger. I mean, for those of you who are out there, remember the 80s made-for-TV movie based on reality, Ted Bundy. Beautiful white guy, intelligent, former law student. Question is, how could he do that? It's because almost all the pictures you saw of Ted Bundy was of this really good-looking Pierce Bronson-like character.
even on the covers of the books that were written
exactly.
about him.
Exactly. I mean, they made a made-for-TV movie about him. They didn't do a made-for-TV movie about Alton Coleman when he was killing people in Illinois. They didn't do one on the D.C. snipers. But Bundy.
I mean, because he represented a departure. It
from
was
what they expected.
Man bites dog.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing with serial killers. I mean, almost all the serial killers you actually know about, to your point, are white guys. Bundy, Mason, or Manson, I should say, mm-hmm. Richard Speck. I mean, you go all the way back to Jack the Ripper. These are white guys. Why? Because it's like, first of all, they're going to be less noticeable because they're not being followed around the stores. They're not the original suspects. They're not who you think a criminal would look like. I'm a 6'3", 240-pound black guy. I know, despite having 3 college degrees and all of this sort of stuff, being top teacher at OSU, if I go into a store, I'm going to be followed. So I mesh the stereotype. So to your point, the images that people already have in their mind and the images that you actually see on TV, they're not surprising. This is the case everywhere.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Well, to the point of what he just said about the stereotype, I personally was attacked by the stereotype. I had it twice in my life, and I got to tell you, if for somebody to say that doesn't affect your way of thinking, I don't think they're entirely being honest with themselves or others to say that it does not change your frame of thinking.
Well, are you saying that Lanier or Scott are saying that stereotypes don't matter?
Well, what I'm saying is that before my attacks, it didn't matter. But now, it does, because I look over my shoulder and I see somebody that's 6'3" and black, and I flinch. I'm not proud of it, and it bothers me. But it's like an alcoholic.
Here's a question for you.
Drink.
Here's a question for you. Are you nervous when you see a white guy under a school? Are you nervous when you see a white kid wearing a trench coat in the middle of the summer? Hmm. Because those are stereotypes. Does that affect you?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't attacked by them.
Mm-hmm. Not personally affected by it. What do you think about that, Lanier?
Well, I think he has an interesting thing, but I think your stereotypes are also steeped in a lot of things that you not even you are aware of. For example, if you're thinking every black guy who's large is going to attack you, I don't even know how you operate in society. Mm-hmm. Because pure and simple, if one episode actually sends you to the point where you're afraid of every single thing, if you get attacked by a dog, are you afraid of dogs? If you get attacked by, if a bird poops on you, are you always looking up in the sky every single day? Is what you're saying is because one black guy attacked you, de facto find all black guys suspect?
Mm-hmm. Scott Duxbury?
I think one of the other kind of an analogy that kind of brings out the difficulties in making this association is that oftentimes when we try to justify our own racial beliefs, we bring up these personal experiences with people of other races. Mm-hmm. And we often forget that really all violent crime is carried out by men. The gender gaps in offending are much bigger than racial gaps in offending. And so by extension, if we were to think that this is a reasonable way to view the world, then shouldn't we also flinch every time we see a male?
Right. Mark, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate that. I have to say goodbye to my guest, Scott Duxbury, sociology doctoral student at OSU, lead author of the study that shows that media treats white mass shooters more sympathetically than black mass shooters. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you very much.
And also Lanier Holt, OSU communications professor, former newspaper reporter, apparently former top professor at Ohio State.
Yeah, that was an award I got back in 2013. We joke about it at my department because they're like, yeah, you got that your first year. More people actually knew you in administration than knew
had
you in your department.
You.
But I can't win it again, so it's a good thing to have under.
And no take-backs, right?
Exactly.
Well, Lanier, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to delve a little bit deeper into how journalism students are taught these issues and how things could change going forward in our how we cover violent crime in general in the United States. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We know the all-too-familiar wall-to-wall coverage that follows a mass shooting. There's the breaking news, then investigations into the perpetrator, and finally the aftermath in the community, and how and what the media chooses to cover during a mass shooting can have long-lasting impacts. Jacqueline Schulkraut is an assistant professor at State University of New York in Oswego. She researches the topic of media coverage in mass shootings, and she joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the purpose of your field of study, what is a mass shooting?
Well, we take into consideration a broader range of qualifications than a lot of the other definitions do. You know, a lot of definitions out there, which I believe was also the basis of the study that you guys have been talking about, mm-hmm. was that four or more people have to be shot. And while the loss of one life to gun violence is absolutely one too many, there are qualitative differences between a gang shooting, a familicide, and a shooting like Parkland or Columbine. And so our definition more broadly takes into consideration those motivations. So effectively, you could think of it more as the public mass shooting versus just the general mass shooting.
And I'm thinking of a Columbine thing. I think that's what most people think of. They think of Columbine, they think of Virginia Tech, that sort of thing.
Correct, yes. And of course, now with, you know, Parkland as the sort of next generation Columbine, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And why does that make a difference?
Well, you know, if we're going to create policies or, you know, delve into the issue of trying to prevent these events, we have to be able to do so in their context. And context is really, I think, one of the biggest things that's missing from these discussions. You know, it partially due to the media coverage makes them look like they're epidemic, partially because there's no precise definition and no, you know, set national data source on events. It makes it really hard to understand the problem as it exists. And if you don't have that foundation, it makes it even more difficult to create policies aimed at preventing it.
Yeah, when I was preparing, I saw that there still is no national database for these kinds of shootings.
Correct, yeah.
What in the world? How? Why?
I wish I knew. I think that's the million-dollar question. You know, I think we do a very good job of, you know, of tracking our crime statistics in this country, but for some strange reason, we have not yet done it with mass shootings. And I think probably, like I said, the starting point is really the fact that we just don't have an agreed upon definition. You know, I remember earlier this year when Parkland happened, and there's a very prominent gun violence prevention organization that was saying, well, it was the 17th or 18th shooting this year. Hmm. And the problem with that is that that's also counting accidental discharges where nobody means to harm anybody, suicides, and things of that nature. And so, again, the loss of one life to a gun is absolutely one too many. But when you break the numbers down, Parkland was the third shooting, not the 18th. And that's a very significant difference.
And it changes how we study them because the variables change when you reduce it to that three.
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, if we're talking about things like threat assessment or our lockdown procedures or protocols, certainly Parkland has highlighted a number of systems failures that not only allowed it to get to that point, but also allowed for the lethality on the day of the event. You know, it's really important, as I said, just you have to have that context. And if you're looking at all of these other things, it doesn't really make the picture as clear.
You know, we've been talking about today, just not about, of course, everybody wants to prevent mass shootings and violent crime, but the ancillary effects of how we cover it have long-lasting and big issues for
Absolutely.
Us. That is just the bias and how that impacts how we treat each other. And your work, you analyze media disparities in reporting on mass shootings, shooters' race. What did you find from your research about media reporting disparities on white people versus people of color?
Well, we looked specifically at what factors were more likely to influence whether or not a story was covered, and if it was covered, what led to changes in something having more coverage versus less coverage comparatively. And while there weren't any racial or ethnic demographic differences in terms of whether or not the shooting was covered, that is to say, they didn't make the decision on whether or not they were going to cover the story to begin with based on who the shooter was. It was more, had more to do with the body count and whether or not it was in a school. But when you look at sort of how much coverage, how many articles are written, how many words are printed in those stories, what we see is that Asian shooters and shooters of other descents, like Middle Eastern shooters, are actually receiving more coverage comparatively than white shooters.
Is that something new?
You know, I don't necessarily know that it's new or not new. I mean, the problem with trying to answer that question is we have a very, very small amount of events that we can really analyze. And so, you know, and that makes it very hard to look at trends over time. We also didn't really have Middle Eastern shooters probably until the 2000s and till today, with, of course, things like Fort Hood and San Bernardino and Pulse. So I don't necessarily think that it's new. I just think it's very difficult to capture when sort of that trend started.
When it comes to reporting on these shootings, how does the media's coverage and the choice of what to cover make a difference in the aftermath of the tragedy? Is there any way to understand that fully?
You know, I think one of the biggest things that we need to look at is the way that we're covering the perpetrators. I work for a campaign called No Notoriety. It was started by Tom and Karen Teeves after their son Alex was murdered in the Aurora Theater shooting. And they're calling for a limited use of the perpetrator's name and image. And there's two reasons why we ask for that. The first is that by continuing to plaster these individuals' names and images across television screens and newspaper pages and all over the internet, what we are doing as a society is effectively rewarding them for killing people. Part of the reason that they're going out and doing these acts in such a very public manner is that they want some type of attention. You know, it's sort of the old adage that there's no such thing as bad press. For them, it's that. That's one of the biggest issues, and we know that to be the case because the Parkland shooter said that in his manifesto that they subsequently released. And on the day, or I guess it was the day after the shooting at Santa Fe High School back in May, the perpetrator told police, "I specifically didn't kill certain people so they'd go tell the media what I wanted them to tell them." That right there, that's not any of us in the research field having to predict why this is happening. That's the killers telling you what they want. And so continuing to give them what they want is extremely problematic. The second part of that, you know, sort of the flip side of the coin is not only are you rewarding them, you're incentivizing other people who might have the same feelings. Hey, I don't have enough attention. Maybe if I go out and kill somebody, I'll get on TV and everyone will know who I am. And there's nothing saying, no, that's not going to happen, because to them, all signs point to, yes, this is what's going to happen based on the precedent of constantly covering the perpetrators instead of the survivors, the victims, and the heroes that are coming out of these events.
I get the reward and the incentivizing thing, but I'm trying to figure out how do you balance that with the public's right to know?
The public absolutely has a right to know, and we're not in any way suggesting that they don't, nor are we suggesting to infringe upon the First Amendment rights of the freedom of the press. But you can very simply put the same information out and say the perpetrator or the suspect without having to give that individual's name. It makes it more banal. It means that they don't have that, their name doesn't carry any weight. You're not giving them that attention, what they want. We're almost 20 years later from Columbine, and you can ask everybody, people still can tell you the name of those two shooters, but they can't tell you the names of any of the 13 people that were killed, let alone all of the 13 people that were killed. Same thing with Parkland. And that's problematic. That's not who we should be focusing on.
That's a value judgment, though, isn't it?
No. I mean, we know, again, we know from the killer's own mouths that they want to have attention. So you're giving them what they want. You can still learn all of the details and all of the information needed to, you know, determine motivation, et cetera, without having to name them. You can still talk about the where, you can still talk about the why and the how, you can even still talk about the who, but that name doesn't have to be part of that.
I've noticed that the media is, and when we say media, I mean broadly, large newspapers, and to a lesser degree, television and the web are trying to, in the aftermath of mass shootings, identify the victims more thoroughly, do little thumbnail sketches of them. Does that matter?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you think about what these individuals are taking away from society. you know, I'm actually in connection with a number of people from the Las Vegas shooting, and one of the survivors' family members posted a scholarship fund that they've started for the children who lost parents in that shooting. 51 children lost parents, just 51 children, excuse me, who were under the age of 21, lost parents in that shooting. Why are we still talking about the person who did that and not what a loss to society those 58 people are, and the fact that these 51 children don't have their parents anymore?
What about our need to understand why?
You can still understand why. We can still talk about motivation. We can still talk about the case facts if there's any evidence, but we just don't have to give them that same information with the name. I can very easily say to you, the perpetrator's motivation was X, Y, or Z. You're getting the same information. We're not giving the shooter the credence.
What else can the media be doing to better cover these shootings? You know, we were talking about this knee-jerk reaction to explain the behavior by mental illness or by background and that kind of a thing.
You know, I think, and it's probably going to be a very unfavorable response, but I think that we as a society have to realize that the likelihood of us ever finding out why is very, very slim. And it's very simplistic, I know, for me to sit here and tell you and your listeners that bad people do bad things, which is ultimately what this boils down to. There's no one consistent predictor of why these events happen. They're as varied as the individuals who go out and commit them. And so continuing to, you know, it's good to understand things in terms of warning signs and threatening behaviors. For instance, we know that in 100% of cases, there are some instances of leakage or letting people know in advance that they're going to do something, whether it's direct or indirectly stated. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that we need to know, because that's where we got to today with having things like threat assessment teams. But if we're going to have the conversations, we need to be having the right conversations, and continuing to jump to conclusions, and especially in the immediate aftermath, it just can't happen, because what it does is it sends us as a society down on the wrong path, and that's why here we are 20 years later, and we've made virtually no progress since Columbine.
You know, how much is that just our, it feels like we overanalyze at the time, but we underanalyze over the long haul.
I think that that's a great way to put it. You know, I think that we have a very short attention span as a society to these events. You know, one thing that really stands out in my mind was the coverage of the Las Vegas shooting. Here you had 58 people who were killed. You had more than 500 others who were shot. And within 2 weeks, the media had moved on. And ultimately, as a result, so had society. And it's only now that the MGM is suing a lot of the survivors that we're even talking about it again. You know, I think we need to have, as a society, a very long-standing, protracted discussion about these events. It should never be, oh, that happened, what do we do now? It should be, what can we do today while there's not a shooting happening to prevent it tomorrow?
Well, who should be leading that discussion?
Everybody should be leading that discussion. And I know that that sounds, you know, that might sound like a cop-out, but I think we all have vested interests in different ways. You know, I certainly come at it from a research perspective as a national expert, but, you know, I also have friends who have children, so I don't want to see their children end up in one of these situations. I'm also from the community that the Parkland shooting happened in. I've been there. I don't want to see other communities turn into what I've seen my community turn into. So, you know, that's just my personal stake in it. Parents who have children, they should be on the phone with their kids' schools, finding out what the active shooter protocol is and how they help to train and reinforce the lessons that their kids are being taught at home. Schools have a responsibility to have those plans into place and to make sure that their teachers and their staff and their administrators are getting the training that they need. Law enforcement, again, has a vested interest also to be part of that conversation, because they're going to be the ones who are responding. There's so many different layers about who should be having that conversation, and I think these conversations, everybody should be responsible for them.
Jacqueline Schulkraut, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Jacqueline Schulkraut, she's an assistant professor at the State University of New York in Oswego. She researches the topic of media coverage and mass shootings. Thanks to everybody for listening today. Thanks for your calls. Appreciate it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.